It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in our second half hour, well, you probably heard Donald Trump is not a big fan of the United Nations. In fact, he called it in a tweet in December just a club for people to get together, talk, and have a good time. Sad was the end of that tweet. In our second half hour, we'll talk with the executive director of the Iowa United Nations Association. Andrea Cohen will be with us. But first of all, my guest in the first half hour is Roger Ferguson, a former vice chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States. As the only governor of the main governing body of the Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C. on 9/11, he led the Fed's initial response to the terrorist attacks. He took actions that kept the nation's financial system functioning and reassured the global financial community that the U.S. economy would not be paralyzed by that terrorist attack. He is currently president and CEO of TIAA, one of the world's largest asset management companies. Thousands of Iowans participate in TIAA. It's also an underwriter of NPR. And we welcome into our program Roger Ferguson. Welcome to our program.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
We want to mention that you'll be giving two public talks today, April 11th, at Iowa State University at 4 o'clock. You'll be talking about your personal journey with diversity. You are an African-American. And at 5:30, you will be talking about how to build financial security in a changing world. I'd like you to address that in just a moment. But Roger, if I could ask you to give us the view of the news this week in the financial industry through your lens. Monday was the original deadline for the financial industry to comply with a rule crafted by the Obama administration to protect Americans saving for retirement. Obama's economic team said everyday Americans were losing billions every year from retirement accounts because financial advisors have conflicts of interest that give them incentives to, say, steer clients into mutual funds with excessive fees. The rule of the Obama administration required advisors to stop that practice and to act in their customers' best interest. That's the key phrase there. But President Trump has delayed that rule for 60 days through an executive action. He's directed his administration to review the rule. It's thought the new administration may even try to change or get rid of the rule. First of all, tell us the key phrase, financial advisors, I hire a financial advisor, I expect him or her to act in my best interest. What is so controversial then about requiring that to happen?
Well, we look at this from the standpoint of my company, TIAA. And in fact, we've always put the customer first. That's always been one of our core values that defines the way we do things. And therefore, we were one of the few, maybe the only company that publicly supported this rule when it was proposed by the Department of Labor. And we are, while there may be fixes that may be called for, some tweaks here or there, we are absolutely directionally supportive of the original rule to make this an industry standard. Mm-hmm. And while the enforcement of the rule, the implementation of the rule may be delayed a little bit, as you say, by about 60 days, we are clearly moving forward to be ready to comply with the rule by June 2017. And our efforts to comply will go unabated, even if the rule is somewhat delayed. So we think the best interest standard, which is one of the technical parts of the rule, are very important. And our goal is to continue to provide the highest quality education advice possible within the guidelines of the rule. So we're supportive.
Mm-hmm. Give us a scenario, because this is hard to understand for some people, that a financial advisor, you'd sit down with them and they would, unbeknownst to you, be acting on a sort of hidden agenda that they don't share with you. And I heard you loud and clear. That's not what TIA does. But give us a scenario of how this happens every day in the financial industry.
Well, there are different standards that are applied when it comes to selling or providing financial products to individuals. One standard, which is the normal one, is what's called the suitability standard. And that simply says that this product is, as the name indicates, suitable for you. It may not necessarily be the best product. It is suitable, however. And so that is the baseline. Mm-hmm. And what this fiduciary rule is attempting to do is to raise that standard a bit to, as you say, putting the customer interest first, best interest standard. And so, you know, all financial services companies are bound to provide products that are deemed to be suitable, but this is moving to a higher standard of really putting the customer's interest first, and we think that's the right way to go for the reason that you point out. I think many people assume when they talk to an advisor that the advisor is indeed putting the customer's interest first and looking for what's in their best interest, not merely what's suitable.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on what you think the Trump administration will do in this delayed time? Will it try to change the rule or get rid of it? Thoughts there?
I think it's anyone's guess as to exactly what they're going to do. I think certainly there are procedures. I won't get too technical. There's something called the Administrative Procedures Act that controls the way rules are written or even removed from the rule book, if you will. And that involves having a period of comment and notice and other things. So I think they are unlikely to do anything without going through the right sets of procedures. So I'm expecting during this period of delay, they may go back out and ask for further comments from the industry and maybe find ways to recraft the rule to reduce some of the objections.
Mm-hmm. Also, would it depend on how people react, everyday people?
I think it will. One of the things that I've noticed being a reader of the financial press and looking at the ads is many companies are already positioning themselves trying to catch up with TIA in terms of putting the customer's interest first. And so I think to some degree, as you are reacting, others will as well, and think it would be a little odd to withdraw this rule in totality. So my expectation is we'll see a version of this rule, maybe with some tweaks and some fixes, for the reason that you are implying, which is people assume and expect that when they talk to an advisor, as they do with us, that we will continue to put their interests first.
I suppose at the very least, if this rule should not be enacted, there's at least an awareness raising that has taken place that when I visit or anybody visits a financial advisor, one of the questions is, no, I don't want to know what the products are that are suitable for me. I want to know what are the best products for me. And I guess I could ask my financial advisor, what are you making on product A versus product B?
Oh, absolutely. As you say, you've sort of strayed down to the area of financial literacy. This will be one of those things that raises the awareness of the average consumer. I think you're also right that there will be clearly a focus on fees, either visible or embedded. One of the things that we at TIAA are really proud of is that our mutual funds in the TIAA Craft family of funds are always in the lowest quartile. So we think it's important to talk about fees, because fees are one of the ways in which individual returns can be gradually eroded over time. And I do think if this rule creates a greater level of financial literacy and makes for smarter consumers, that's all for the good.
Mm-hmm. Roger Ferguson is with us, president and CEO of TIAA, one of the world's largest asset management company. He's in Ames to give a couple of presentations later today. If you have questions, we have Roger with us until almost half past the hour. Your questions about financial security, saving for retirement, maybe how to deal with that student debt hanging over your head, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit about what you want to get into this afternoon when you talk about being financially secure in a changing world. What are the main points you want to make about our world and keeping track and secure in your finances?
Two or three major points. One is that indeed everyone should focus perhaps more time on their own financial well-being. There are some studies that show, believe it or not, that individuals spend more time planning a vacation than do planning for their retirement. And so I will try to be creating a rallying cry of, you know, take a real look at your own financial health. Second thing is that does involve having a degree of financial literacy, the type that we've just talked about. You know, the degree of financial literacy in America is woefully inadequate, given the fact that we're all making very important decisions that may impact us for many, many years to come. And then the third thing is there are, even in the world of financial literacy, a small number of touchstone, you know, lessons, if you will, around saving and investing. One is, you know, the sooner you start saving, the better off you'll be. You know, the miracle of compound interest, as Einstein called it. The second point is, you know, think about having a diversified portfolio. Don't go for just one home run stock and, you know, hope for the best. And the third is to really be aware of your risk appetite. There's some folks, when it comes to finances, get very jittery when the market goes up and down. There are others who are, you know, calmer in that regard. And so there's some very simple lessons, but it also goes back to understanding, if you will, your own psychology when it comes to money. I guess the final point I'm going to make, because we will be talking to a student audience, is that retirement is something that is in the future for sure, but it's inevitable for everybody. And so one should start to think about retirement and saving for retirement even at a very, very young age, the age of students today here at this campus, for example.
Mm-hmm. Roger, there are predictions, have been for some time, of a coming stock market correction. The stock market's been doing very well lately. But the thinking goes, historically, on average, a crash comes about every 8 to 10 years, a correction, I don't know, 30, 40% or so. Are we due for one?
You know, it's hard to say. And the reasons it's hard to say are, indeed, you know, you're right, this stock market advance rally, if you will, has been going on for 7, 8 years since we came out of the crisis of 2008-2009. On the other hand, the U.S. economy still appears to be, you know, relatively strong. It continues to grow, not at a very rapid pace, but it is continuing to grow. Unemployment is still coming down, even though there are clearly pockets of unemployment that are higher than anyone would like. But the underpinnings for the market look favorable. The other point I'd make is corporate earnings, which should drive the valuations of stocks, still look, you know, solid. And then the final thing, of course, is, you know, the new administration is promising a number of things that might be really helpful in terms of keeping the equity markets moving forward. Corporate tax reform, infrastructure investment, individual tax reform, et cetera. And so all of these points, a relatively strong economy, you know, good corporate earnings, and the possibility of some policies that are supportive, might give this market advance, you know, greater longevity than the numbers that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. What do you look to as indicators, red flags of imminent time for a correction? Do you have anything you can call that?
One of the things that we know by looking back at these corrections is there really are, you know, relatively few red flags. If you think about reasons that stock market corrections have occurred in the past, there have been, obviously, the bursting of the internet bubble, for example, where, you know, people, individuals were buying stories not driven by the reality of earnings, for example. A few other corrections in the stock market have been driven by external events, the oil crisis in 73, 74, for example. And then the third thing that has driven corrections in the stock market is the Federal Reserve moving relatively aggressively to stamp out inflation, driving interest rates up, and that tends to also drive down equity valuations. And so as you can see, there are things that have historically been associated with corrections. Some of them are surprises, such as an oil shock, or some of them are maybe in some sense inevitable, investors buying stories that aren't supported by the reality of the companies in which they're investing. And so, you know, when one looks around, it's hard to see any of those things necessarily on the horizon. But of course, since one of them is a surprise, by definition, a surprise is something that you don't foresee. Mm-hmm. On the horizon.
Let's get in a call or two. Dennis is with us from Cedar Rapids, listening in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Dennis. Welcome to the program. And you have a question for Roger Ferguson of TIAA.
I have a question and a comment. The comment is, I've been with TIAA or TIAA CREF, as it was, for about 30 years, and I've been very pleased with the performance and the feeling of security that I have with TIAA.
Great, Dennis. We're pleased.
Early on in my investment years, I'm a retired teacher, never had all that much to invest, but early experience, I found out that my investment advisor was doing some churning. And does the current regulations as far as fiduciary trust for the client, would those be looking out for things like churning?
We'll have to clear up what is churning.
I'll try to define it. I think churning is basically, you know, the buying and selling of stocks maybe more frequently than is in the interest of the clients. It is not something that we at TIA would do ever, but perhaps others do. And indeed, that is one of the things, Dennis, that I think would, by implication, come under a lot of scrutiny under a fiduciary rule, because it's hard to argue that rapid buying and selling of stock, which generates fees perhaps with a stockbroker, is necessarily in the best interest of the client. And so I think that would probably be something that is certainly quite limited. It's not something that we at TIA would ever condone, obviously.
Okay. Dennis in Cedar Rapids, thanks for that question. Anne from Ames called, is not on the line, had to go for some reason, but asked how TIA balances fossil versus green investing. And perhaps I can add there, is that a trend in the industry to have mutual funds that have a green tinge to them?
So let me answer the first part of the question. We have a long history of having socially screened investments. In fact, our socially responsible investing account is the largest and one of the oldest. Secondly, we have recently come out with a, if you want to call it, a green fund for those who wish to invest that way. But we also recognize that, frankly, for better or for worse, in the modern economy, fossil fuels still drive much of the consumption. They provide much of the energy, and those companies also prove to be good investments. And so we are always trying to balance the desire to really participate fully in all elements of the global economy, while also recognizing that for many of our participants, having, to use your phrase, been a green tinge to their investing is important, and so we give them that choice. We believe that choice is really important when it comes to investing, based, again, on individuals' risk appetites. The other point I'd make is we are a large owner of commercial real estate, the third largest in the world, and we spent quite a bit of time thinking about energy consumption in our buildings. To try to reduce those carbon footprints in the buildings that we own.
Okay. Roger Ferguson, in the last 5 minutes here, I'd like to ask a little bit about the topic you'll be addressing also here in Iowa, your personal journey with diversity, part of your talk. First of all, you are an African-American, and I'm just wondering, do you have any idea how many African-American economists of your generation there are in the U.S.?
By definition, a relatively small number.
Okay.
That's about as much as I can tell you.
Okay.
But the truth is that it is becoming a discipline that's becoming much more interesting to many people of color. And indeed, later this week, I'm going to be on another campus talking to a number of Hispanic and African-American economics undergraduates. And hopefully I can, convey to them some of the excitement of what some people have erroneously described as the dismal science.
All right. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing and what led you to investments, being fascinated by this area.
As with many people, my parents really were the primary drivers of who I've become today. My mother was a school teacher, very interested in education, and encouraged all of her kids, including myself, certainly, to get as much education as we could. My father was a child of the Depression, and for him, the Depression created a real interest in banks and interests and investing. He wanted to know what was this banking system that could bring the U.S. economy to its knees. And so when many dads would be talking to their young sons about box scores and sports, while my father was interested in those things, he also spent a lot of time talking to me about the stock market and interest rates going up and down on CDs, for example, and the kinds of things we've just talked about. So I grew up in a house where the modern word financial literacy was part of what was happening around the dining room table. And then the final thing that really triggered my interest was 1965, 1966, President Johnson nominated a fellow named Andrew Brimmer to be the first black governor of the Federal Reserve. Andy was a storied economist, had started out as the son of a sharecropper. So, that was exciting, but what was equally exciting was this thing called the Federal Reserve System that I knew very little about. My father spent a lot of time talking about interest rates, And lo and behold, I discovered that there was this very important institution in Washington, D.C., that had something to do with setting interest rates. And so it all sort of, you know, came together, and economics became a passion for me, along with investing in financial literacy.
Mm-hmm. Being a Black American, what sort of discrimination did you face? I don't know if you bring this into your talks that you have here, especially given your area of study as an economist.
There's no doubt that growing up, I faced discrimination. When I was growing up, Washington, D.C.'s public school system was segregated. Some of the movie theaters were segregated. And indeed, some of the department stores had, you know, entrances for colored people only, if you will.
And you remember this in your lifetime?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I remember the first time I went to a school that was integrated, which was in the seventh grade. It wasn't sort of brutal in the sense that people, you know, think of certain, southern states and things of that sort, but it was part of the existence. There was a very famous amusement park right across the line in Maryland that closed when I was a kid instead of becoming integrated. And so this was part of my life. However, the flip side of this was I grew up in a very strong community, very diverse socioeconomically, not very many rich people whatsoever. It's what we would call a low and moderate income neighborhood, but one in which, at least in my household, the thought was race was part of who you were, but it didn't define all of who you were. And we had to go out and strive and achieve through the use of education. And I discovered that I was actually a pretty good student, and it was a way to move forward. Mm-hmm. And so the discrimination and the segregation of my youth didn't define me whatsoever. Unfortunately, I grew up in a household where I had a lot of the tools to confront that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. In just 20 or 30 seconds, what is your view of where we are in terms in this country of addressing racism and racial inequality?
Look, I think we still have a long, long way to go. Both in a macro sense and in a micro sense, I think we have not yet become the colorblind society that most of us aspire to be. Having said that, the fact that I can come to Iowa and have a really honest discussion about my own journey on diversity tells me that people are curious and interested and trying to do better.
Very good.
I'm always optimistic.
Thank you for stepping into our studio, Roger Ferguson. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
President and CEO of TIAA. When we return after a short break, I'll talk with the executive director of the Iowa United Nations Association, Andrea Cohen. We'll talk about the Donald Trump planned budget cuts for the United Nations, among other things. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, I hope you'll tune in. Politics Wednesday. Our guests tomorrow, Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. Plenty of politics to discuss, of course. We'll be talking a little bit of how the politics and the workings of the U.S. Senate are changing in light of that rule change we had, the nomination of the latest Supreme Court justice. But today, in a tweet back in December, then-President-elect Donald Trump called the United Nations, quote, just a club for people to get together, talk, and have a good time. Sad. End of tweet. Well, among Donald Trump's planned budget cuts as president announced last month are major cuts to U.S. contributions to the United Nations and international programs. It's against this backdrop that we've invited Andrea Cohen, executive director of the Iowa United Nations Association. That's a division of the UN Association of the USA. Andrea, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Iowa United Nations Association. Many are hearing that, I would assume, for the very first time. Tell us who you are.
The Iowa United Nations Association, just like you mentioned, is a division of the United Nations Association of the USA, which is a great tongue twister. But to put who we are and what we do into context, I think it's important first to talk about what the UN is, because mm-hmm. many people have an idea of what the UN is, and most of it is speeches in the General Assembly and votes in the Security Council, but that's a lot more than.
Yeah, we experience that on our news, precisely those two images.
Yes.
But what is it besides that?
It's, well, let me go back. It was established in 1945, officially on October 24th. So it's an old institution. It started with 50 members and now has 193, and that covers pretty much every country in the world. The name itself was coined by FDR, so that's kind of cool. And it's the successful successor of the League of Nations. So the League of Nations was Woodrow Wilson's idea in 1918, and the U.S. never ratified that, so it never happened. But the U.N. came out of the ashes of pretty horrible devastation in World War II, which showed the extent to which government can abuse its citizens. And afterwards, it was like, well, never again. And the U.N., like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, protects citizens against government. So I hope that's clear. It rose out of people's aspirations to make sure that government treats its people well. And its purposes are primarily to do this by peaceful means and not by war or not by any type of aggression from one country to another. So I think the most important thing to know is that the UN behind the scenes has, I think it's something like 70 funds, agencies, organizations that are all working around the world for health, education, refugees, economic development, sustainable development, peace and peacekeeping, human rights, you name it, it's the whole gamut. And so you probably have heard of UNICEF.
Mm-hmm.
Which on October 31st, everybody goes around with little orange boxes collecting money for UNICEF. You may have even heard of the World Food Program. These are all UN agencies.
UNESCO?
UNESCO is another one, and we're a city of literature, a UNESCO city of literature. Are you familiar with the World Bank?
Sure.
You're probably familiar with the World Health Organization or the International Monetary Fund. But are you familiar with the UN Population Fund?
No.
And the UN Conference on Trade and Development and the UN Environment Program.
I have to say no to that one, too. So there are lots of, you were saying there are lots of branches, some of which we've heard of and
right.
others that are busy, but we just don't see them in the news very often.
You don't see them in the news, and they do incredibly important work by vaccinating the vast majority of children around the world. We're responsible, actually. Well, I shouldn't take credit for anything. The refugee situation we have now with 65 million refugees, it's the UN that is the first step that refugees take to becoming or to acquiring the status of refugee. Once mm-hmm. that happens, then this another 19, 20, sometimes 25 steps takes place before a refugee gets into a country where they will be welcomed with open arms.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really pivotal and critical role.
Now that you've outlined a number of the things that the UN does, let's talk about your specific organization, the Iowa United Nations Association. You are there to do what?
The Iowa United Nations Association is here to educate about, promote, and advocate for the UN in the state of Iowa. And we have – every state has a chapter or more or a division or more. And the reason to do that is because it actually started when Eleanor Roosevelt came to Iowa in 1953 and gave us our charter to start. That was her big work after she had chaired the committee that finally came with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So she said, I want to keep on doing my work about the UN, and she went all over the country to set up chapters and divisions for the UNA USA. That's how we started. And the idea was people need to know more about the UN. And the more you know about it, the more informed you are about it, the more you can make an informed decision about whether you agree with it or not, whether you want to support it or not, whether you want to become a member, donate, you name it. So that's what we do. We also educate. We have educational programs where we introduce people to various parts of the UN. For example, there's a new one called Adopt a Future. It's to set up schools with school supplies, you know, everything from brick and mortar to blackboards in the largest refugee camp in the world, which is in Kenya. So we not only want to do education about the UN within the state of Iowa, we also want to help others get access to education, which is so primary.
To be clear, the Iowa United Nations Association is not a part of the UN. You are not funded through that agency.
Not at all.
You are funded how?
We are funded through membership.
Okay.
Even our national office, the UNAUSA, is also funded through donations and membership.
So this is an organization to raise awareness about the United Nations and its many actions around the world. Among the people, concerned citizens who
exactly.
believe in the beliefs, the goals of the United Nations. So let's talk about the defunding here. The present administration planning budget cuts announced last month, major cuts to U.S. contributions to the United Nations, to international programs. I don't know if you have more than I do as far as the latest. What are you hearing about defunding of the U.N.?
We've had this on our agenda since January when an executive order was on the table to be signed by the president to defund, or there's always a difference between defunding it, withholding, withdrawing from it, or defunding parts of it. The way that every country contributes money to the UN is very complex, and you can defund in various different ways. So having said that, we were successful, certainly through our national office, in getting that executive order on the back burner. So that was one front that we were able to successfully stop what I keep calling attacks on the UN. Then there are three bills in Congress right now, one in the Senate, another one in the House, and a companion bill in the House to the Senate one. Also to defund or reduce funding in certain ways for the UN. The skinny budget that was introduced a couple of weeks ago also talks about defunding the State Department, and it is through that area of funding that the UN is funded. And many of the comments that we have when we talk to our elected representatives in Iowa, we spoke to Senator Grassley, and one of the main concerns is reform in the UN. It's a big bureaucracy and it's complex. Well, yes, it is. Mm-hmm. But
critics would say, use words like bloated and biased.
Right. Bloated, I would possibly agree. Actually, I would agree. Even the Secretary General agrees with that.
Bureaucratic, not using
yes.
the money as efficiently as it might.
Exactly. Although, to convince me, you would have to show me that all the stuff that's going on behind the scenes is not being done efficiently. And I know it's not 100% efficient, but I think withdrawing doesn't constructively solve the problem. Countries, well, U.S. leadership in the UN is very important. And if we forfeit that position, who's going to take our place, and is it somebody that we could work with? It would also mean that rather than working together with other countries, we would end up working unilaterally and trying to make treaties or goals or achieve our national security goals alone. And I can't quite see how that would work.
How seriously do you take the talk of this administration, by this administration, to whatever degree it's true, of pulling out of the UN entirely, as you just alluded to? How serious do you see that as a threat?
I personally don't. I think that many of my colleagues would agree. We just had our national vice chair here to visit at the Model UN in Cedar Falls, and we talked about that, and we are confident, I'll say carefully, that that's not going to happen. It
confident because of what?
Because I don't think that, as I said before, withdrawing from the UN isn't going to solve any problems. It just takes away some money, mm-hmm. And there could be other ways to do that. Plus, it would hurt the United States in the long run, because we are dependent on global trade. We are dependent on those international relationships. If you think about it very simply, if businesses in the United States can't get the type of employees that they're looking for with the skills they're looking for, they're going outside. Not that they're not training them here to finally get up to par in that sense, but if you are not part of this international conversation, then how are you going to get these people to come in here?
If you just joined us, Andrea Cohen is my guest this half hour, Executive Director of the Iowa United Nations Association. The other criticism from this administration has been voiced: bias. The context that I've seen that in is one, that it's biased against Israel, for example.
That's interesting. Senator Grassley felt that it was bias for Israel, at least in our conversation with him. So that I'd have to know more, because this is not something I usually hear.
How does our congressional delegation in Iowa feel about the UN and its continued funding and existence?
They are all – well, we haven't spoken to everybody yet – but they are the ones we have spoken to are all in support of the UN and what the UN stands for. They do criticize the use of the funds, the fact that the U.S. pays the majority of funding to the UN. But I think one of the things that's forgotten is we also get a lot in return for that large amount of donation that we make, or assessed and voluntary contribution. We get $500 million in contracts from the UN come back to the United States. For every dollar we invest, we get 160 back. So I think that there's also a good economic argument to remain in the UN.
The numbers I have are that the U.S. contributes over $2 billion to the total budget of more than $8 billion. Mm-hmm. This was last year, according to Foreign Policy. So a quarter of the U.N.'s budget paid for by the United States, even though there are 100 and how many countries?
Right. But that gets into how those contributions are assessed, and that has to do with population and GDP, and it's all very complex. But I think it's also important to know that what we contribute to the UN is only 0.1% of the federal budget, or 0.01. In any case, it is minute compared to the entire U.S. federal budget.
What are some of the other most common misconceptions you run into about the UN that you think people are misjudging the UN on?
Primarily because people don't know how complex and how large and how broad it is, that most people only know the UN as an organization that comes in for – it's not a misconception, actually. It's a good conception – is coming in with humanitarian aid. For example, in South Sudan right now, there's famine on its way, or it's there now. I'm blanking out on the other thing. Doesn't matter. Anyway, so I think also misconceptions about the fact that what the UN does, such as vaccinating a lot of people around the world, especially children, is something that is vitally important. It's also an organization that makes sure that disease doesn't cross borders. I mean, you know, disease like pollution doesn't recognize geographic borders. It just goes its merry way, and something's got to be done to stop it. And on an international scale, you need an international organization to do that. So I think people think that, well, we can do it in the U.S. or we can do it in the Netherlands, where I'm originally from. Doesn't work that way. Because you need that international cooperation.
Let's take at least one call before we have to say goodbye. Is it Sabra in Iowa City? I hope I got your name right. Sabra?
Sabra.
Sabra. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Sabra. Well, welcome to the program. We don't have much time, but what is your question, your comment?
Hi. So I was calling in. I'm actually an intern for the Iowa United Nations with Andrea, and I was calling in just to let you guys know about an awesome event that we are holding at the end of the month, known as Hike to Help Refugees or March to Help Refugees. It's an event that's going on April 29th, starts around 10. Basically, what our event is trying to do is to educate the community on the refugee situation happening in Syria and in parts of Sudan and other countries that are unstable enough for people to want to seek refuge. So we'll have a little portion of like just having a discussion about it. What is going on? Ways that you can help around in the community. We're going to have a org little exposition at the end where people can come and talk to different local organizations and stuff. And then we will show our solidarity by having a march downtown. And another big goal that we are trying to achieve is we want to raise $1,000, which is very ambitious, for the UNHCR or the United Nations High Commission for Refugees to help benefit Syrian and Sudanese refugees right now, just because they are kind of on the forefront or the largest demographics that are seeking refuge right now.
Okay. Sabra in Iowa City, thank you for your call. To finish up here with Andrea, tell us a little bit how people can find out more about you, since we've only had a few minutes to talk here, and what more about the Iowa United Nations Association possibly getting involved.
Well, we're a statewide organization. We have chapters in Johnson County, Linn County, Des Moines, Ames, Fairfield, and Cedar Valley. We're a nonprofit. You can become a member. An introductory membership only costs $25. You can donate to support our educational advocacy and humanitarian programs and expand them around the state. Or you can volunteer. You can attend our events, which would be wonderful. The best way to do it is to go to www.iowauna.org. And you'll see membership information there and also more about us. And please forgive us. We're updating our website. Mm-hmm. And questions can come to me directly. That's Andrea at unaiowa.org.
How has the interest or involvement been in the last few months since there's been talk of cutting funds to the United Nations?
It's growing, I like to say, by leaps and bounds, but we'd like to think that. We had our Night of 1,000 Dinners event at the beginning of March, which was this year focused on refugees, and it attracted more than 200 people, and we raised $2,000 for the Adopt a Future School program in Kenya. So we're seeing an increase. We're seeing an increase in interest. We're seeing that people are trying to find a forum where they can talk about international issues, but also do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you measure success?
Interesting question. There are different ways to measure success. First of all, you can't measure success of raising awareness in any tangible way.
That's why I ask it. It's a hard thing to do, isn't it?
It's a very hard thing to do. But we measure success partly by participation in events. We measure success by people who, when they find out that I work for the Iowa UNA, or that some of our board members and other members work for the Iowa UNA. Oh, you're doing good work. That's really great. And I think that's a measure of success. And I don't know. I think that's the greatest way to measure success.
Okay. Raise some awareness about what you do, what your organization does this hour. The Iowa United Nations Association, executive director was with us this half hour. Andrea Cohen, thank you for being with us. We appreciate that.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Coming up tomorrow on this program, of course, it's Politics Wednesday. Plenty to chew over domestically and international in terms of politics. To do the chewing, our analysts, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University and Dennis Goldford of Drake University. We hope you'll join us. with your questions and comments. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury with help from Anna Williams and Chelsea Hoy. We always welcome your comments and questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.